Hello, everyone, and welcome to the YJBM podcast. Today, we have an interview guest. This is Allison Chase with us today. I am Mara Grishelman, second-year PhD student in microbiology, and with me are Dylan and Liv. Welcome, Allison. Happy to have you here. How are you doing this morning?
Good. Thank you guys for having me. This is a super exciting opportunity for also me, but also my lab. So we're really happy to talk a little bit about the work we do.
Thank you so much. All right, so we're just going to start off with a little bit of introduction. So can you tell us about your background and what led you to specialize in neurodegeneration?
Sure. So as you guys may or may not know, I'm a second year grad student in the neuroscience department. A little bit about my background as far as neurodegeneration. So I went to the University of Connecticut. I majored in physiology and neurobiology. We didn't really have a lot of like neurodegeneration research going on there. So I kind of outsourced and took on a few other research opportunities in different universities. My first experience was working in Brad Hyman's lab at Mass General up in Boston. We studied Alzheimer's disease, mostly focused on trying to understand protein regulation from more of a tau perspective. Which is one of the main pathologies in Alzheimer's disease. And then more recently, later in my undergraduate career, I worked here at Yale in Steve Strittmatter's lab, who also studies Alzheimer's disease. But that project was mostly focused on amyloid beta, which is kind of the other main pathological hallmark in the disease. That's kind of where I got my start. And now I'm in Jinghu Lim's lab, like I mentioned, in the Department of Neuroscience and also in genetics, where we study spinocerebellar ataxia type 1, which is a genetic neurodegenerative disease. And so that's kind of what I'm, how I got to where I am. And I'm excited to talk about current work.
That's great. So what specifically led you to join the RIM lab?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one of kind of the big pulls towards the RIM lab, we have expanded quite rapidly since Jinghu joined. I think back in 2013, our lab is pretty large. We're about like 18 members total, very grad student heavy lab. And I think a big part of that is the environment. We kind of have cultivated a really strong and positive lab environment. But then, of course, the other big pull for me was the science. I definitely wanted to kind of stick down the neurodegeneration route. And so I kind of was looking for that in a lab, but also a field that's not as big as Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of researchers that study AD, and so SCA1 is definitely a smaller field, but you can ask very similar questions across the neurodegeneration space.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you so much. And then now we're just kind of getting into the basics of, you know, what neurodegeneration is. So for our listeners who might not be familiar, could you explain what neurodegeneration is and how it relates to human disease?
Of course, yeah. So neurodegeneration is kind of, I mean, if you break down the word itself, you have neuro, right, which is the study of neurons or brain cells, and then degeneration, which as far as neurodegeneration is kind of considered, is thought to be like original or early on in disease, kind of neuron dysfunction. And then as the disease progresses, eventual death of a specific neuron population. So this can vary kind of across different neurodegenerative diseases. So the common ones, right, are Alzheimer's disease, so the loss of like cortical or hippocampal neurons, also Parkinson's disease, the loss of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra, and then in SCA1, mostly focused on the loss of cerebellar Purkinje-cell neurons. And so how might this, I guess, relate to human disease? Humans are living much longer, so I think there's a lot more research focused on like normal aging, but also neurons dying. And so AD, for example, I think the incidence rate is like 6.2 million Americans, so this affects a large population of individuals. So it's a big focus right now, I think, both in the clinic but also in the lab.
That's so interesting. Could you delve into the specifics of SCA1 and how it typically progresses in patients?
Yeah, so SCA1 is a very rare genetic neurodegenerative disease. So it affects only about 1 to 2 per about 100,000 people worldwide. And the onset is usually around like the 30s and 40s. And like I mentioned, it's an inherited neurodegenerative disease. So for example, AD has a genetic component, but is also sporadic. SCA1, we know the root cause, which is due to a polyglutamine or CAG repeat expansion in a human ataxin-1 gene. SCA 1 is also a part of a family of SCAs. So there's also SCA 3, SCA 6, caused by different mutations in different genes. And the duration of this disease is usually about 10 to 30 years. And typically, SCA 1 is kind of categorized as the loss of Purkinje cell neurons, which are found in the cerebellum. But because of that, patients usually experience symptoms like gait impairment and ataxia. And then as the disease progresses, patients also experience bulbar dysfunction. So they have issues like respiratory complications, swallowing deficits that are usually terminal.
That's very interesting. I've never really heard of this topic before. And then it seems that there's like a lot of variability that goes on with it. On the behind SCA1 pathology, like, is it a relatively, you know, new discovery? Like, is it well-researched or...
Yeah, so I think one of the big things to consider here is even though SCA1 is a pretty small field, we're asking very similar questions as like many other neurodegenerative diseases and researchers are. SCA1, as far as like a pathological standpoint, there's a lot of patient studies that have been done to try to better understand the atrophy going on in the brain. And so we know that the cerebellum is widely atrophied, but there's also other brain regions that are affected, which not a lot of people are studying. So there's atrophy going on in the cortex, atrophy in the brainstem, and also spinal cord damage. So our lab is kind of also studying extracerebellar brain regions and trying to better understand what could be going on there. A lot of researchers in the SCA1 field kind of use a few main models. So, I mean, we'll probably get into this later, but one of... the main tools we use in the lab is mouse genetics. And so we use two different mouse models, one of which is a knock-in mouse model in which ataxin 1 with 154 poly-Q repeats is expressed under the control of an endogenous promoter. So it's expressed appropriately across cell types and brain regions, kind of better recapitulating human disease. But then we also use a transgenic mouse model in which 82 poly-Q repeats are expressed specifically in Purkinje cells, which I mentioned is like the main cell type affected. And so these two kind of tools, in addition to a variety of others, kind of help us better understand pathology and how it might relate to the human condition.
Would you say those mouse models that mentioned are like a good representation of human disease, or like do you think there's some way to go? Like, what's it look like?
Definitely, yeah. So I think mouse models, of course, are like a very useful tool. They also can be one of our major drawbacks, right? We can't perfectly recapitulate human disease. And they also, one of kind of the drawbacks of studying neurodegeneration is it takes a long time to age these animals out to a time point that replicates what's going on in the human brain. And of course, not everything's perfect. So in our lab, we actually have kind of a host of different models. We have a fly model in the lab. We also have a SCA1 zebrafish model. We also use human-induced pluripotent stem cells. And so we have a lot of kind of compatible tools to try to kind of supplement the deficits using mouse models.
This is actually very interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about the stem cell stuff? Because, I personally don't encounter that in my research, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I personally don't do the stem cell work in our lab, but we actually have a really talented postdoc who is working to not only use like cortical stem cells from SCA1 patients and also SCA3 patients, but also looking at different neuron glial interactions. So for example, we're also working on culturing astrocytes. We have other students who are interested in oligodendrocytes. So that's kind of another route we're going. Our lab has previously also worked to develop patient organoid models, so kind of 3D patient brains, but in a dish. And so that's kind of another exploratory model. And kind of the hope with all of these is to, of course, identify potentially therapeutically relevant targets and see how patient cells might actually react to these.
That is absolutely amazing. I love hearing about organoid stuff. It seems very futuristic, so, even though.
Definitely.
So could you talk more about the specific aspects of the problem that you're investigating in this research? Because it sounds like everything you're doing is so cutting edge.
Yeah. So we actually had a very recent publication come out a few months ago by several members of our lab. This was a large and very collaborative project focused on like the transcriptomic changes that are happening in the SCA1 knock-in mouse model. And so the whole purpose of this project was to really understand not only what gene expression changes are happening in Purkinje cells, but also in other cell types. So an important, I guess, point to note is that ataxin 1, the causative gene for SCA1 1 is expressed across all cell types in the brain. And so when we think about neuron vulnerability, we're not just thinking about how neurons alone are changing, but also how other cell types might be contributing to neuron death, neuron vulnerability, neuron dysfunction. And so some interesting findings that we found was that 1 cell type, which are known as unipolar brush cells, which are an excitatory glutamatergic interneuron population found in the cerebellum, actually undergo significant transcriptomic changes and are kind of a not widely studied, at least from the mirroring perspective in the SCA1 field. And so this opens up a lot of kind of interesting avenues for current projects in the lab. Another important finding that kind of came out of this work is that there's a lot of changes happening to oligodendrocytes and oligodendrocyte progenitor cells, which is a glial population mostly associated with myelin, which kind of wraps axons. And so we're definitely exploring both kind of these other interneuron and neuron populations, but also kind of focusing on these glial aspects of disease as well.
So just like give it all to your experience and, you know, everything you've mentioned so far, you know, I know this may be a broad question, but like kind of what led you to this interest in neurodegenerative diseases? Was there like a single spark that, you know, really like, you know, got you into it, or was this like, you know, something that you first heard about in like maybe a lecture or, and then you started to, you know, learn more and more about it?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So when I was in undergrad, I really thought I wanted to go into medicine, which I think is actually kind of maybe a fun fact about a lot of grad students, at least in my department, is a lot of people started off as pre-med before switching over. And I think a big thing for me was when I was in college, there was a course on central nervous system diseases. And I knew that that was my interest based off of previous research experience and also like familial and personal reasons. But I just was really excited by this disease and thought that, oh, the best way to help these people is in the clinic. And I think a big part of that is true. But for neurodegeneration, there's a lot of unknowns and a lot of pieces to the puzzle that we just don't have the answers to right now. And I think a lot of the answers are kind of found in the lab. And so that was my big pull for kind of switching over from the whole med school idea to grad school idea. And I definitely see the LIM lab generally as a very translational and translation focused lab. So we are doing basic research, but the big questions in the lab, the conversations we're having in lab meeting are definitely how can we help patients? And so I think that was the big pull for me for neurodegeneration and also kind of what keeps the lab pushing along.
I can totally relate to the pre-med and then grad school pathway. It happens a lot. Can you talk about a bit more about the like translational aspect of the lab?
Yeah, sure. So we have previously done a lot of collaborative work, not only with other labs, but also with different companies. One of kind of the big, I guess, treatments or things in clinical trials right now, at least for SCA1, is focused on ASOs. And so we've done some previous work kind of with ASOs and trying to modify protein levels. A big part of our lab that I guess I haven't mentioned yet is focused on protein clearance. A lot of neurodegenerative diseases like AD, for example, are kind of characterized by protein aggregation. How can we better regulate the lysosome to better facilitate clearance of these proteins and regulate neuron health? And so we've done a lot of work in trying to modify protein levels and focused on those sort of pathways. And so that's a huge translational aspect. Additionally, a lot of the work that's going on in the lab focused on glial research is kind of intertwined with this new focus in neurodegeneration on not just neurons, but also non-neuronal glial cells, which were originally considered to be support cells to neurons. But now we're kind of realizing that they might actually take a primary driver or causal contributor role to neurodegeneration. And so we're hopeful that our glial focused work can maybe contribute to biomarkers or, again, potentially therapeutically relevant targets that could be beneficial for these individuals.
I just have one question. What exactly are ASOs?
Yeah. So that is a very, very good question. So ASOs are antisense oligonucleotides. And so you can use these to kind of target RNA or modify protein levels. And so a lot of people are using these targeted against ataxin 1. This is not just for ataxin 1, but also other causal proteins. And so these have been useful in the clinic and not fully successful, I would say, which is, again, kind of a hindering factor of a lot of these neurodegenerative clinical trials. They haven't been fully successful, but that's kind of one of the major focuses, at least for SCA 1, is trying to modify these mutant taxon levels and bring them back down at least to lower levels to hopefully hinder, if not halt, disease progression.
I see. And what would you say, like, why is that such a challenge to treat neurodegenerative diseases specifically? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think this is a very good question. We haven't seen anything, I think, that's been fully, I mean, even for example, in Alzheimer's disease, there's been a lot of focus on kind of working towards sequestering, for example, amyloid beta plaques, which, like I mentioned previously, is one of the major pathologies in AD. And I think one of the reasons that we haven't been fully successful in kind of curing or treating neurodegeneration is there's a lot of kind of parts to the picture. I mentioned previously that, you know, now we're kind of changing scope from just focusing on neurons to also focusing on glia. And I think there's also a lot, I mean, without being repetitive, a lot of pieces to the puzzle here. So even if you correct one thing, doesn't mean that there's not going to be other secondary issues that are going wrong. And so I think it's really, at least for our work in the lab, we're trying right now to better understand kind of underlying mechanisms that might be continuous across neurodegenerative diseases, so might be useful for many diseases. But I think hopefully, maybe, you know, I don't think in my time, but in the future, to have more personalized treatment. I think that's going to come from really understanding the pathological mechanisms of disease. And I think the tools that are coming out now, especially large omics studies, are going to be really useful in better understanding those really maybe minute but important and intricate molecular mechanisms that might kind of tie a lot of these features together.
That's great. So moving more into the logistics of your research, what methodologies have you employed to study these subjects?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier, we're using a lot of single-cell RNA sequencing, which can be very beneficial. It's very hypothesis generating, but they're also very large data sets. They're very expensive to do. Right now in the lab, we're focusing mostly on the cerebellum, given that that's one of the major regions affected in SCA1. But we're also thinking about using other sorts of sequencing mechanisms like spatial sequencing to better understand the spatial localization of changes in the brain. I mentioned before that we use a lot of different model systems in the lab. So we have both different mouse models, fly models, zebrafish models. I mentioned iPSCs before, or induced pluripotent stem cells, but we also use human postmortem tissue, which is really important in terms of validating the findings and see how they might affect the human condition or might be happening in the human condition. We also do a lot of behavioral assays, which, especially in SCA1, where there is a lot of motor impairment, this can be really helpful in kind of validating some of the findings or phenotypes that we see in our mouse models. And we're also thinking not only about these physical impairments, but also mental phenotypes. So we're thinking about depression as well as cognitive impairment that not only we see in SCA1 individuals, but also in other neurodegenerative diseases like Huntington's or Alzheimer's disease. And my PI, Jing Hu, he's always excited about expanding beyond. So, of course, we're thinking about collaborations with other investigators here at Yale to kind of expand our technological toolkit. And I think that will be exciting in the future.
Nice. So you mentioned, you know, like, I know there's a specific, you know, way to kind of determine what are the findings, right? But, like, you know, I know you mentioned, you know, there are phenotypes in the mice population. You know, sample mice population that you kind of deal with, are those phenotypes the main model that you take as a result, or are there different avenues in which you kind of like take in the data and then turn that into, okay, this was the result of this experiment?
Right. Yeah. So I think a big part of using mouse models, there's a lot of published literature, at least for the knock-in mouse model and the transgenic mouse model we use to study SCA1. There's a lot of studies kind of highlighting common phenotypes, whether that be motor limb issues. And that's really great to have, at least as like a validation that what we're seeing is accurate. But a big part of what we do in the lab is using very common molecular techniques. So we do a lot of pathological analyses using histology. So we'll section brain tissue and actually staying with different antibodies to look at neuron death, to look at gliosis or reactive astrocytes and microglia, And a lot of that recapitulates what we know to be true in human brain. And we can validate that also with human postmortem tissue. So there's lots of different ways to kind of gather information and phenotypes about the animal model we're using and see how well they kind of match up with human data.
So for listeners who are not as fluent in molecular biology, could you explain RNA sequencing and sequencing approaches in general?
Yeah, sure. So this is obviously a huge topic, generally speaking. Most of the work that we're doing right now is single cell RNA sequencing and specifically single nucleus RNA sequencing. And so there's lots of platforms out there. Our lab uses 10x Genomics. And so what we do is we'll take, for example, the cerebellum of a mouse, and we will perform what's referred to as nuclear isolation. So we'll isolate just the nuclei of individual cells and then send those off for sequencing. We'll gather counts of RNA expression, and we can put those into a processing pipeline to actually visualize and cluster cells into groups. So for example, we can not only look at Purkinje cells, but we can also look at astrocytes, microglia, all gathered from that one cerebellum. And then we can perform what's referred to as a differential gene expression analysis, which allows us to look at gene expression changes in each cell type. And so this kind of gives us a good idea of what's going on molecularly. And there's a lots of downstream processing that we could do, one of which is referred to as gene ontology. This can kind of give us an idea of some of the more concrete changes that are happening as a result of these gene expression changes. So we can take our whole list of genes that are changing in individual cell types, throw them into platforms like, for example, Enrichter, which is a widely used public resource. And those will give us some changes that are happening. So, for example, we can see if there are synaptic changes happening. We can understand if there's RNA splicing changes that are happening just based off of that list of genes. This kind of comes, though, with, I guess, its own caveats in that it will give us an output of changes, but we need to, of course, validate to make sure those changes are actually happening in vivo. And so we'll identify specific targets or pathways that we can look up antibodies or different markers of, and then study those in the brain and in human. And so this will give us kind of a good, I guess, lots of questions to then ask, but then places to validate. And that gives us kind of a good understanding of what molecular mechanisms are happening rather than just kind of characterizing broad changes. And I think that's kind of where a lot of the field is going now.
Got it. And you may have mentioned this before, you know, but like just kind of based on your findings, you know, what are the potential implications for, you know, the treatment of SCA1, Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases? You know, I know you mentioned that, you know, more long term, you're looking at personalized care, right? And maybe you can kind of like touch on, you know, what that may imply. Is that more like, you know, you get a personal, you know, genetic, I know, you know, people are throwing the term around like genetic counselor, like sometimes just like, you know, just looking ahead far into the future, but like, yeah, so.
Yeah. So this is a really good question. So as far as treatment, we are definitely thinking kind of broad first, because personalized treatment, like I mentioned, is probably years down the line, even though, of course, we all want that right now. We're trying to better understand mechanisms across neurodegeneration. So a big one, for example, is protein clearance. We're also trying to understand the role of neuroinflammation. So understanding how glial cell types like astrocytes or microglia, which are thought to maybe clean up and help and be neuroprotective early on. So kind of providing beneficial support to neurons early in disease, how that might later become detrimental to neurons after. So whether they stop doing their job or they become toxic to neurons, how that might look. And so I think a big part of this is kind of identifying potential biomarkers. So there's been a huge shift, I would say, in recent years from a clinical neuroimaging perspective on identifying, for example, PET radioactive tracers that can study neuroinflammation or specifically activated microglia is the big one right now. This can be really useful in kind of identifying or better staging disease progression. At least in the SCA1 field, there's been a lot of focus on glutamate regulation. So glutamate release from the synapse happens all the time and is very normal. But if there's glutamate buildup, this can be excitotoxic to neurons and can be really detrimental. So there's a lot of work on really regulating glutamate clearance and the role that astrocytes might have, for example. So I think that's kind of where we are right now in SCA1, at least. but we're definitely thinking ahead and trying to think about how might we not only draw ties across neurodegeneration, but also thinking more about even changes that are continuous across different types of SCAs, for example, and different polyglutamine repeat diseases.
While we're on that topic, what are the differences between different SCAs?
No, that's a really good question. So different SCAs are caused by mutations in different genes. So that's really the big difference between them. However, we do notice that there's lots of continuities across different SCAs, for example. So SCA3 is another very well-known SCA. There's a lot of research and funding going into studying SCA3, but there are a lot of similarities between SCA1 and SCA3. So for example, our recent publication in Neuron, we identify using transcriptomics that there's a lot of myelin changes that are happening in SCA1. And this is also a very common phenotype in SCA3. We see a lot of myelination deficits. And so there's definitely continuities across diseases. And so we have partnerships with researchers like Haley McLaughlin, who also studies SCA3 to kind of study this intersection. Of course, the SCAs are polyglutamine repeat diseases. So is Huntington's disease. And so we're also interested in thinking kind of broadly about maybe a small scope relationship between polyglutamine repeat disorders and then larger scope continuities across neurodegeneration.
All right. That was a great definition. So you had mentioned earlier that we are pretty far off from seeing any kind of curative therapies. So in terms of the next step in trying to create therapeutic solutions, how far off do you think we are from that in terms of moving forward with neurodegenerative research?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of push right now. There's been some really amazing progress, at least from Alzheimer's disease perspective. So approval of, for example, therapeutics there. I think for SCA1, we're definitely set back a little bit just because the field is much smaller. But I think there, at least from what I've heard, there's a lot of biotechs, like, for example, Biohaven locally, that is working on kind of applying therapeutics that are useful in other areas to the SCA1 field. And so I think we're getting there. I mean, I wouldn't say we're like super close, but I think as far as like therapeutic relevance goes for SCA1 field, we're trying to catch up. I think of course, like I mentioned previously, like a decade ago, there wasn't a lot of focus on glial interactions or glial neuron interactions. Now there is a lot of emphasis. And so I think we're definitely making steps in the right direction.
Got it. And, you know, just looking at the future in your research, you know, I mentioned that, you know, your lab likes to really try to, you know, expand and reach out to other labs for like maybe partnerships. But like, you know, are there any upcoming like joint projects that or studies that you might be excited about? It doesn't have to be joint. It can also just be, you know, individual, but just like kind of looking into the future.
Yeah, of course. So there's tons of exciting work in the lab. As far as what I can really say, as far as upcoming projects, we have a lot of grants in the work, mostly focused on collaborations. Something that we're super excited about is Heather Snell is a new faculty member who just joined the neuroscience department. She has a lot of specialty in using electrophysiology to actually study the electrical activity of Purkinje cells, which are the main cell type affected in SCA1. So just at a like lab-to-lab level collaboration, we're really excited to work and partner with her to better utilize the mouse models, the disease mouse models we have in the lab, and study more neuron activity and how we might alter different cell types in the brain. So using conditional mouse genetics, how that might read out from an electrical standpoint. And so that's kind of just one example of the collaborations we're working on in the lab.
That's excellent. And it's great to hear so many positive interpersonal relationships coming between different lab communities. So throughout your career specifically, what has been the most rewarding discovery or moment for you?
This is a good question. I'm very early in my career, so I haven't had anything like super, well, maybe breakthrough for me. But I think the biggest moment in my career thus far has been coming to Yale. As an undergrad researcher, definitely in the pandemic, there was like a lot of limitations on research, generally speaking, but also the undergrad university I was in, there wasn't a huge emphasis on the area I knew I wanted to go into. And so coming to Yale, there's a huge community of people interested or interested adjacent in neurodegeneration. And so that, of course, opens up a lot more collaborations, a lot more questions and tools that can be used to answer those questions. And so I think there's just a huge interest in neurodegeneration here and a lot of people who are excited to kind of expand and work and collaborate.
Got it. And then so, you know, how can the general public or interested individuals support research in neurodegenerative disease?
Yeah. So the public, we in our lab, at least, we are excited and welcome the opinion of the public. For SCA-related work, there's been a great resource that's been funded and supported by the National Ataxia Foundation called SCA-Source. And so this is not limited to SCA1, but also to many other polyglutamine repeat diseases. It's kind of a it's a website where researchers and different PIs across institutions kind of write in plain language for the audience of lay people to better understand the science that's going on in the lab, to kind of get an update on these clinical trials that are happening and to become, you know, more active participants in the research we're doing. We obviously want public feedback, and so this is a great opportunity for that. Personally, one of my favorite activities that I just partake in as a member of the public is kind of participating in different funded activities for neurodegeneration. So one that I do yearly is the Walk to End Alzheimer's Disease. This is a great opportunity just to participate in a yearly walk with other members of the public who are interested in supporting neurodegeneration research and cures to end these neurodegenerative diseases. And so that's another really great opportunity to not only meet other public, maybe their invested families or patients themselves, but also to interact one-on-one with researchers and really get your questions answered.
That sounds incredible. So rolling back to your career again, what is one thing you wish you knew before beginning your research on neurodegenerative diseases?
Yeah, this is another really great question. Neurodegenerative diseases, at least in the lab, take a lot of time. These are diseases of aging. So like I mentioned earlier, I mostly and primarily use mouse models. And so right now, kind of the average timeline just to kind of wait is like a year to a year and a half for these animals to begin to show phenotypes, at least for the mouse models that I use. Some of them are definitely quicker, but that being said, it does take, you know, a lot of time. For PhD, for example, I think the average time in my program is like 5.5 years to graduation. And so for mouse models, you take a lot of time of just preparing these mouse models, crossing them and waiting before you can actually get in and analyze your data. And so I think time and dedication is a huge one. But also like perseverance, that like everything that we're finding out here is another really important piece to the puzzle. And so it's worth the wait. And you know, there's a lots of interesting avenues, lots of different model systems that can be used for quicker turnaround. But I think to really get into what's going on in disease, the time is worth it.
Sounds good. And this is our final question. Thank you so much, by the way, Allison. You've been these answers have been great. I've learned so much personally. But like, you know, what advice would you give to young scientists or anyone who wants to get into research? Interested in neurodegenerative disease research or just like research in general?
Yeah. So I would say just reach out. I mean, when I was an undergrad, I mentioned previously my institution didn't have a lot of research focused on the field of my interest. And so I was just reaching out to PIs who I was interested in their research and kind of seeing what the interest was back. And my lab, the LIM lab, for example, were very receptive to that. Not only is our lab very graduate student heavy, but also very undergrad heavy. And that's because we spend a lot of time training our undergrads and really value their work as scientists. So as an undergrad, I would just say reach out to your labs of interest, kind of feel out what the lab culture is, the environment, and see if the science is a good match. Yeah, so that would be my biggest advice, I guess, to young scientists.
This is wonderful. Allison, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, guys.
And as we wrap up, I would also like to thank all of the listeners for being with us during this episode. Our guest today was Allison Chase, and I am Mara. My colleagues are Liv and Dylan. And this was Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine podcast. We hope to be back soon with some more exciting interviews, and we hope to see you back as well. Have a wonderful day.